Welcome back to the Criterion Not Podcast, the podcast where I just had a time of my life. Our Criterion Collection. This is the season finale. I started booking people and recording last April, so I feel like a year is a good amount of time to spend on a season, I think. I thought I had a couple more in me, but I had a cancellation, and then there was a celeb that I've been trying to pin down who couldn't record for another couple weeks. And so I thought maybe this should be the last episode. And when I thought that, it really sparked joy. A wave of relief washed over me, I'm not going to lie. Partially because I'm working on something that is now taking up a lot of my time, all of my time, and I'm going to be traveling soon for this project. So I just didn't feel like drawing out the end of the season and, you know, whatever. As Oprah says, listen to life's whispers. We are ending season two on a dark note with Darren Aronofsky's Requiem for a Dream. We had a bit of a recording issue. Both Matt and I forgot to start recording, so the intro I did isn't on tape, so I'll do a little one now. Matt is an incredible editor. He's edited films like Enemy by Denis Villeneuve, Swiss Army Man, directed by the Daniels, starring Daniel Radcliffe, the television show The OA, the upcoming Noah Baumbach film starring Adam Driver. He's the real deal, and he's got a great perspective on this film as an editor. We met because he edited some music videos I directed back in the 2000s, and he started editing Shit Girls Say, but I was a control freak, and I wound up doing the editing of that myself, which we get into in our discussion, so please enjoy hearing me talk in my straightest, manliest voice to my dear pal, everyone's crush, the sweetheart, Matt Hanum.
Have you ever had a guest who's slept in the bed that you're sitting on?
Yeah, you. I was going to ask if you if you recognize this bed. I've set everything up in Montreal as if it was in LA, and I'm like, everything's fine. Everything's fine. I never left. Everything's fine.
this is like a test. This is also, I'm your former editor tenant.
I know. You know, so connected, yet so distant. And I'm so glad that we're reconnecting because it's been a long time. I haven't seen you maybe since your birthday at Sidecar or something.
Yeah, it was a long time ago.
Yeah, ages. But you're in Cleveland?
Cleveland. Yeah. You're in Montreal.
Yeah.
Wow. How's Montreal treating
international? I love it here. I love it here so much. Yeah.
How long did it take you to decide to move there?
I came last summer because I started looking at places in Toronto. Once I knew I'd be staying in Canada, and it was so depressing that I took a little trip to Montreal to check it out and pretty much immediately was like, yeah, I'm going to be
so much better.
What are you doing even?
I'm here. I'm editing a Noah Baumbach movie and we're shooting here.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah. It's fun. It's good.
Oh my God.
And so we have been here since June and we'll be here until like Halloween.
Holy shit.
Yeah. It's a long shoot.
I had a class with Noah's brother, Nico.
Oh, yeah.
And I loved him. He was great. But I haven't met Noah. But it's going well. You're directing, your second unit directing.
Well, I'm not really. I mean, I guess that's the job I'm fulfilling. I'm supervising the splinter unit, but for all intents and purposes, you know, we're shooting some text and a POV. We do like the mop up, they call it.
Okay.
So it's like stuff that wasn't worth shooting.
I've never made a feature, so I wouldn't know.
Well, I've never made one. It's like, you know, if there's no actors, like an insert, things like that. We just kind of
Need them. Just the stuff that is needed. Well, that's cool. I mean, how do you feel about that? Do you want to keep going in that direction? Do you want to keep directing? Do you want to do more of that? Or
I don't know. Yeah.
You like being in your little hobbit hole.
I mean, I'll tell you what. Hobbit buttons are good. I think this is a really satisfying movie. Like I'm loving the movie, and the more movies I do, I don't know, like I'm feeling more engaged right now. I mean, I do want to make a movie at some point, but it's kind of like, I mean, this is going to be a 2-year job, you know, so it's hard to think beyond that.
That's wild. And does that sustain you for 2 years, or do you have to like do you do commercials?
I want to, but
we've done music videos together and then, but you can't. What do you mean? Oh,
no, not that I could not, but I just, it's like for me to go It's like I have to be at a company and I have to have time to do it. And every time I try to do it, I don't have time. So
I think that things are changing and you don't have to be repped anymore. Maybe it's different for editors. Maybe it's more because you have to be, there's like the whole vibe of like enticing directors and production companies and agencies is still there.
Yeah, but
a director maybe is a little bit. Yeah. Yeah. We have a kitchen. We have a chef.
And he'll
what
also
the fuck are you talking about?
I don't know. Yeah. You know. How much does it cost? Oh, okay. Oh. And the chef? How much if we just leave the chef off?
Yeah. Why don't we just not? Oh, well, thank you for doing this. I know we've been trying to make it
work. I know. That's my pleasure. That's my pleasure. I was so happy to see, Requiem for a Dream. I've got thing. I mean, I got enough. I got a little juice to talk about.
Okay, good, because it bummed me the fuck out. And I'm so excited to hear what you have to say, because I like the first time I saw it, it really bummed me out. And then the second time I saw it, I loved it. And I was like, oh, there's a lot more hope in this than I thought there was. And then this time it bummed me out. And I think it's because like the second time I watched it, I was at like maybe a really low point or something. And so it seemed more hopeful than it
better,
is.
Yeah.
And then this time I'm like, I'm happy. And that really darked me out. So
yeah, it's like an optimism thermometer.
Yes. Oh my God. Exactly. That's exactly.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it's so ludicrous that it didn't really bum me out. Like the thing we were talking, I watched it with my girlfriend and we were thinking about it. And it's like, the thing that bummed me out is the mother character. It's so depressing because it seems real. Like it seems like something that's happening, you know?
Yeah.
And she's so good. Ellen Burstyn is so good in this movie.
She's so good. Okay, wait one second. One technical thing. Are you recording on your end?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Okay. So Ellen Burstyn, she...
Now you got me nervous.
No. Okay. Check.
Hold on. I'll go check.
Check.
I went out to test it and stopped, and then I started again.
Oh my God. So it's going.
It's
and
going.
It was going
now.
Before, and there's just a little.
Yeah, there's a lag. But
okay, that's fine.
Should we start? What did I say? Is there
Ellen
anything
Burstyn.
We're saying?
No. So Ellen Burstyn, she was nominated. She didn't win. Is that right?
I think that's right.
I'm so in love with her for going so hard on this role and for trusting her. For trusting Aronofsky to like let her go that far, you know what I mean? Like, I think that like in some ways it's too much almost, or it's like it's really intense. And I think it's also because the scenes go on for so long at some points that she's just in such distress for so long that she had a lot of trust in Darren.
Did you ever read I didn't read anything about the making of this film.
A little bit, yeah.
I think that would be a very difficult part to play. Like,
oh
I,
my God, so hard.
You know?
But her speech when she, or not speech, her monologue when Jared Leto comes over, Harry, her son, and she talks about like why she wants to lose weight and how she misses her husband and his father, and the cinematographer started tearing up and he fogged up the eyepiece and
oh my God.
The camera drifted and like they noticed afterwards that the camera had drifted and it ended up being the take that they used in the film because it was
wow.
so powerful.
Emotional.
And so good. Yeah.
What is the big deal about being on television? Those pills you're taking will kill you before you ever get on, for Christ's sake.
Big deal? You drove up in a cab. Did you see who had the best seat? I'm somebody now, Harry. Everybody likes me. Soon, millions of people will see me and they'll all like me. I'll tell them about you, your father, how good he was to us. Remember? It's a reason to get up in the morning. It's a reason to lose weight, to fit in the red dress. It's a reason to smile. It makes tomorrow all right. What have I got, Harry? Why should I even make the bed or wash the dishes? I do them. But why should I? I'm alone. Your father's gone. You're gone. I got no one to care for. What have I got, Harry? I'm lonely. I'm old.
You got friends, Ma?
It's not the same. They don't need me. I like the way I feel. I like thinking about the red dress and the television and you and your father. Now when I get the sun, I smile.
Wow. Yeah, that's, I mean, that kind of thing is really hard because it's going to feel insane. Like, you know, from making stuff, it's like, it's going to feel insane on set.
Yeah.
You know, but really her going that far and also just all the things that went into her, like her, the production of her, like she's not that old in that movie.
No, fat suits. You know,
the fat suit, all that stuff. It's really interesting. I looked like Darren Aronofsky was like in his early 30s, I think, or like 31 when he made that movie. That's crazy. And it's in a lot of ways, it's like a very immature film because it's just so intensely stylish and you know, all the things we talk about that movie. But really, there is a lot of – there's a very compassionate look at like being an irresponsible child. I wonder how much of that – I wonder where that script came from, yeah. You know?
Yeah.
Because it's like, I don't know about his life.
Did he have drug
addiction? Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I doubt it, but you could also see it being like the guilt of what it takes to, on a, like to become a filmmaker even, you know, it's just like how much, I doubt this is it, but you think about the burden that you put on your family by just being monofocused on doing one thing. And that's the only thing I know about Aronofsky is that he's just an obsessive filmmaker, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Have you seen Pi? I've never seen it.
Yeah. I've seen all of them. I was obsessed with this guy.
Okay. Okay. Oh my God. You know it all. Well, because, and that's like Ellen Burstyn apparently read the script and was like, hell no, I'm not doing this. And then saw Pi and was like, oh yeah, for sure. I'm going to do this. I want to read a little bit of something that somebody wrote about it because it seemed like he was such a called an ingenue or whatever. And like people were really flocking to him because of Pi. And,
right.
But people were also kind of like bitter about it or not bitter, but like, oh, he's just flashy. He's a flash in the pan. He's kind of like, he's like this hot new filmmaker. Who cares? When I started it, I forgot how intensely cut it was and how stylized it was. And just like even the first few shots I wrote, within seconds, I was rewinding it going, whoa, wait a sec. And then like the split screen with Ellen going into the bathroom and the POVs, it's like fucking hard off the bat.
Yeah. Ideas.
And I was like, that's so exciting. That's so cool. I love that. And then I was looking at reviews and one of them was, Aronofsky simply cannot get enough of himself. 30 seconds after the movie begins, he opts for a pointless split screenshot. From there on out, he lays on a repetitive cavalcade of slow motion, fast motion, more split screens, cameras attached to actors, snorri cams, grainy surveillance images, dissolves, fades to black, fades to white, underwater shots, cameras on the ceiling, cameras on the ground, dream sequences, hallucinations, slowed down vocal tracks, sped up vocal tracks, grinding music, electronic blips, etc. You better wear some headgear if you opt to sit through this thing. There's a good chance you'll want to tear your hair out. Paul Tatera from CNN.
Oh, yeah.
The leading source on film. But the things that he hated about it, I was like, this is such fun filmmaking.
It's amazing. And you have to think about what was going on at the time. Like, I remember so clearly it was early internet, you know? Like, we didn't everyone. And so this movie, I think, was made in 99 and came out in 2000 or there's around there.
Yep.
We were using internet at the library and like, you know, it was like, I think I got the internet, I don't know, 1998 or something.
Yeah.
97. Yep. Anyways.
And I was like, underwear.
Totally.
Man, underwear. Penis. Hard penis underwear. Ask Jeeves, where is gay man?
It was limitless at the time.
Yeah.
We're local Gravenhurst men. I remember going to a website for this movie before it came out, and it was just a shot of him at the end of the pier, and it was like a very – it was like you had no
– website.
Yeah, I couldn't believe this thing. I was really shocked. Yeah. And then just working to see it, waiting till it came out in Winnipeg, you know, trying – and so it was a real favorite movie of mine.
Yeah. I mean, also, I mean, I wanted to talk about, like, you were saying of that era, like, I know that he really stylized it based on, like, R&B videos and music videos at the time, which is so now, like, the wide angle cameras and, like, who else uses wide angle? Like, maybe David Lynch or something, you know, like that kind
yeah,
of
yeah, but not even that angle. Intentionally. That was, yeah. like, more, that was, like, totally rap videos, right? Yeah. Like Lil X or whatever his name, like, it looked like a Busta Rhymes video. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was really interesting to watch because it's funny at times this movie was so important because I think that no one had really done that yet. And if you think about what went into doing that on film, it wasn't easy. Like you really had to commit to an idea. Mm. You know, you couldn't like Avid was much more rudimentary and, you know, people were using Final Cut Pro, but it was like low resolution. So doing that stuff was a move and he was committing to it. And I think that like all those wide angle lenses attached to trash cans and like all that stuff, he really was
corner of the room, up yeah. on the ceiling, like that's like
pretty amazing.
Very like, bold moves.
A lot of Fincher stuff in there, I think. I think like early Fincher, there was a lot of like extreme camera placements and things like that. But yeah. I was really impressed by the freedom that he had in making it.
Yeah.
And at the same time, having a cast that was quite bold, you know, like Marlon Wayans. No,
yeah,
Damon?
That was a wild
Marlon.
Choice.
Marlon.
It's Marlon. Yeah.
Yeah. He's amazing in the movie.
He's
you know, like
great. And a comedic actor doing this dramatic part, somebody who may not have been taken seriously. Dave Chappelle was also up for that role.
Oh, really?
And turned it down, apparently.
I think Marlon Wayans is so like, you know, there's that amazing shot later on in the movie of him and his girlfriend, like from above twisting around. So beautiful.
Yeah.
And like Matthew Lee Batik also. I mean, it's funny. I was thinking about the concept of your podcast and how you've done some movies that are a little bit more tongue in cheek, right? Like House Bunny or whatever, like these
no,
movies.
No, that's not tongue in cheek. No, that's not tongue-in-cheek.
Okay.
It's a beautiful movie.
However.
It's not what film bros would call a movie. So
no, but the film bros that run Criterion,
yeah.
I don't
would
know
never
that it,
consider it.
Yeah,
sure.
But this
yeah,
one
but
is
this,
like, oh.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There are a few, and that's what, you know, like some of the films that we talk about on the pod are like, could be or should be, and like very well might be. But I'm curious, like why this isn't like.
I wonder too. I mean, it's. I think it's funny because it what I was getting at with all the style stuff is. It may be something that is slightly maligned in conversation, but when I talk about like, oh, we do a quick cut sequence here, people will be like, well, not like Requiem for a Dream, right?
Yes.
And it's like,
oh my God, I'm so glad you're talking about this. Yes.
It's in the conversation as a sort of like signpost of the times, right? And I think that's interesting.
But do you think it's like, do you think people feel like it's dated because like, or overdone? Is that what you think? Like,
well, a lot of people, I don't think it was overdone because no one really did it in successfully as he did. Like, I don't think I've seen a lot of movies that were like nailing the thing that he did in this film. Yeah. And it's interesting to me because if you look at a lot of stuff, like I'm like Scorsese, I'm not the biggest Scorsese fan. Like I find
shots fired.
Yeah. Right across
Martin.
The mouth.
He's on but next week, by the way.
But it's like you can't argue with him stylistically. He can do – he did stuff that nobody was doing. Like for this movie, we were looking at some After Hours stuff and it's like that movie is stylistically way out there. Or the – what's the Michelle Pfeiffer, Daniel Day-Lewis one? Age of Innocence.
Oh, I started watching that. To be honest, I turned it off. I couldn't do it.
Well, it's a weird, stylish film, but it is incredibly crazy the stuff he's doing in that movie.
Okay.
And all of the Scorsese stuff, I really think that what Darren Aronofsky was doing in this movie is not so far from the things that Scorsese was doing, but he has a solid base of traditional filmmaking behind him. Right. Where Aronofsky came out of the gate, he's like, really stylish. Yeah. Like really wild.
Also, Lee Batik is like a music video director too. And so like that's that time when music video directors were starting to get clout or like be respected finally. But it's funny because like I feel like the quick cuts of the drugs, the needle, the eye, the dilation, the thing, the like sound of the whatever. was so iconic and in a way I wonder if it got too iconic for its own good in terms of like people thinking that or maybe even Criterion people thinking that it's like he overdid it or something when everybody else did, like, I mean, not everybody else, but it shows up a lot. And I think go ahead and do it. Like if you can't improve on that, copy it. It's fine. Like, it's super effective. It gets the point across. It works. I don't think I've ever seen anything else in any movie that depicts what it's like to get high.
I remember the moment so clearly, when they're at the hot dog stand and they're stoned and they play like toss with the gun.
Oh my god! Yeah,
I just remember so satisfying. You know, it felt so good to watch, and that's something that's interesting about independent filmmaking is satisfaction and entertainment, and how much when we're young, I think we really resist pleasure in cinema, you know?
Yeah. And I think it's like painful, like let's watch Haneke films. No, thank you.
Yeah. I mean, they're great and amazing, amazing, but there's another space, which is fun. And fun is a really interesting thing in more serious art house, which I think Requiem straddles a couple of lines, you know, where it's low budget art house, edgy. There's like frontal female nudity. There's needles. There's ass to ass.
Fucking crazy gore, shot in the head, murder shit going on.
It's really dark.
Ass to ass, yeah.
Ass to ass. That's one part I really forgot was the drug deal gone wrong with the deaf guy. That's amazing, that scene.
That's like hard midpoint.
Yeah.
Like just like everything changed. Like, and that's why, so like the first time the second time I watched it, I had forgotten that they kind of almost made it, you know, like they almost
had it. Yeah.
Had it all. Like they were selling the drugs, they were getting their shit together, they were getting their plays together, they were having a fun time. But then, you know, I was going to do an intro. I'll do an intro separately. But like, I was going to say that, like, this is the movie that proves that you shouldn't get high on your own supply. Did I say that or not? I can't.
No, you didn't.
Okay. I rehearsed it, so I couldn't remember. but yeah, it was just, and that's why the second time I watched it, I think I just was like, oh, this is much more hopeful than I thought it was. But the joy in the filming, like, this is supposed to be fun making movies. I don't know. Maybe not everybody feels that way. That's what I want to do. I want it to be fun.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be a comedy to be fun. And doing this podcast and studying film and learning about film, I appreciate so much more when a director is having fun and is like exercising their skill at being innovative and unusual. So
yeah, I think it is really, and that's something that I find is really important, especially doing my job. It's very important to me that I don't bring a lot of baggage to a director and say, no, this is how we should do it. You know, this is how it should be done, which actually like is part of our history, right? Where I just had to tell you on Chick Earl Say, like, I don't understand. I don't think I'm doing a good job. Yeah. Because it's like at that time, a younger point in my career, you have to build up your confidence and you have to try to exercise that a lot.
Sure.
But later in my life, what I've learned is just try to embrace anyone's talents as much as you can,
right,
and go there with them. Like this movie I edited, Swiss Army Man, was where I learned that, because these guys had so many ideas, so many wild ideas.
Yeah, the Daniels.
Yeah, the Daniels. And I had to – sorry, I'm fielding texts from the
Noah,
boss here.
Tell him to go fuck himself. Tell him the squid and the whale sucked.
Graydon,
I'm just kidding.
Says,
I love that movie.
Anyways, those guys – like the Daniels – I had to really realize something, and I think that's one of the things about making movies with friends from film school, which I'm pretty sure that's what Libatik was to Aronofsky, is just like you have to have the same level of freak in you, and then you can really achieve something cohesive. But at times, if you're arguing with style or arguing with tone, it kind of can lead to nothing. You know, like you can kind of get a big, fat plane if – if a person has a lot of creativity and then someone comes into it trying to make it how it should be. And I think that's what these early Aronofsky movies show. It's just like, get wild. Do you remember The Fountain?
Get wild. I do remember The Fountain. It was when I first started directing commercials and I went to, what was that post house in Toronto, Relish? Was it, or five? VF567, and they were doing the post on it, and I remember like being so fucking impressed. I was like, oh my god, they're doing the post on The Fountain, and somebody was rotoscoping Hugh Jackman doing something in the sky, and they were like, this is so much work. And I was like, no, this is so cool, why are you so mad about this? Like,
well, weirdly, so I remember such a cool experience, because I was in Montreal, or The Fountain was shot in Montreal. I think The Fountain was shot in Montreal, because I was working on a job and the post supervisor was like, do you want to come to look at this other set with me? And I was like, oh, I'm good. I'm just going to stay here and work. And it was The Fountain.
Oh, fuck.
And mistake. But I do think that that's an important, I mean, especially, you know, with you, where you had an idea, and, you know, a lot of people resist ideas because they feel scary or dangerous or whatever. And that's what I love so much about Requiem for a Dream, dated or not, is that it is a really, really, really new idea, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, there was nothing like it. Do you think of yourself as a control freak?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I do. I think I like to control what I can. And I think that there are ways that whether they be pharmaceutical or mindful or whatever, I try to figure out a way to let go of that. I think it's really important. Like, you can control something to the degree that is reasonable and within your power. And I think sometimes I have to take that away from the actual like guts of the idea, you know, the intention, and move it to the execution and make it as perfect as I can within whatever I deem my responsibility. I definitely have a hard time when I see something and I don't think it's as good as it could be.
Yeah.
You know? But sometimes people take different paths to get to the final thing. And so I've learned patience for sure.
Yeah.
I've learned over time that one of us might know better, but both of us probably can't get there at the same pace. And so we have to just meet there at the natural rhythm, whether it's trying out a couple of ideas that you're not sure about, or exhausting one idea, then being, I thought this, do you want to see it? You know? And even if that I thought this, do you want to see it, isn't the right idea, it might get the other person in this conversation, a director, to be like, oh, I see what you're thinking, let's try this. Do you know?
Yeah.
And that's the really exciting thing. And it's the interesting question about editorial, because someone like Gus Van Sant, who I really like, I love so much the whatever Death Trilogy, like Jerry and Last Days and those films. Elephant,
yeah, okay.
He edited those himself. Like, he did those by himself.
Right.
And Paranoid Park.
Oh, I haven't seen that one. And we just, like, I've done now 3 Gus Van Sant movies on the pod, but I haven't.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Which ones?
Seen To Die For.
Great.
Good Will Hunting.
Mm-hmm. One of my favorites forever.
Oh my god! Oh, look at the Matt Damon lookalike. Looks like wants to. Does every do they?
When I was young.
You are young. Come on, stop. Stop. No, but I mean, it's interesting about like control. I'm a, like, I've realized that I can be a control freak, and that's a little bit probably what was happening with Shit Girl Say. And if, you know, obviously the listeners don't know, but I had asked you to edit Shit Girl Say after we shot it. And then, and you were also busy. You were doing other things. You were editing for, I think, Patricia Rosen at the time, weren't you? Weren't you doing her series or something?
I was doing something, but I definitely, what I remember and probably wasn't mature enough to say at the time clearly is that I just was like, I remember with Shit Girl Say, I was trying to tell you, oh, well, we should tell a story. Like she goes here and does this, right. You know? Yeah. And you're like, just line up the words. They're funny. And, and you were right. Like there's zero dispute. And it's funny because that was a moment I think about a lot actually because everyone saw it. You know, and it's something that like you can be like, oh, did you see Shit Girl Say? And like, yeah, definitely.
Right.
And it's interesting. And those are moments in your life where you have to be like, yeah, you know, I don't know what's going on here. Like, I don't know exactly. Like sometimes I was working for a while on this Drake documentary.
Yeah.
And it was really interesting because just looking at the footage, it's like you're being in a cultural world unto itself.
Yeah.
And that's a really I mean, I think the fun thing about my job is that you can drop into it. If you can get there, you can drop into a different world and sort of have this personality, you know?
Well, I mean, it's funny because I think that with Shit Girl Say, I wasn't treating you as an editor or wasn't looking to you as an editor, which is something I've learned now is just that. How dare I tell somebody what to do as their job? You know what I mean? Like I was being a real control freak because I had a vision for it. But at the same time, then like, why wouldn't, if I had the vision and the capability to do it, why wouldn't I just do it myself? But it's so funny because I did this commercial in Germany with for some stupid drink and this guy,
Water
Vendors and editor, Tony Froschhammer. Do you know him?
No, that's amazing. What an experience.
Yeah. I mean, like he was editing this stupid commercial and he was so like sure of himself and what he was doing. And I would be like, no, but we should put it over here. And can you try this? And can you try that? Could you try that? And he was like, calm the fuck down. And just was like, back off. Let me do my thing. And he did it. And then I got his style of working and I was like, oh my God. And it was a real.
And what was that? What was the difference?
The difference was that he has his own way of working, his own way of coming to things and that it takes time to edit properly. And you can't just like whip shit together and think like, oh, this is representative of good editing. Like you can try a ton of stuff quickly, but it's not going to represent proper editing.
I agree with you completely.
But he like fucking edited Pina Bausch, the documentary and like other shit. And I'm like coming in like, make the goat sing louder. You know, like it was like,
well, it's funny. I think that sometimes it's like people work at different paces. Like I was working with a friend on writing something the other day, like the other month, not the other day. And he sort of said to me, don't try to get everything perfect on the first round because there's going to be a lot of revisions. Yeah. So we may as well get there. And I think that's really interesting because with editing, it's almost like you have to wait for the calm where everyone sees the same vision, you know? And sometimes, like if I see something in a movie, I'm like, this has to go. But the person who wrote and directed-
like it has to be cut? You mean like-
Yeah. I'm like, it's not working in the film because I'm coming to the script at face value and the footage at face value. But that person has gone through so many iterations of that screenplay, so many thoughts going into shooting it, experience of being on set. And so you really can't push anyone out of their comfort zone or else you're going to be moving backwards because they're going to need to see what was in their head and you're going to make them work to get it. And that's like a really interesting experience. And I mean, if there's any way to relate this back to Requiem for a Dream, maybe they put a little too much of that stuff in for people to fully absorb the movie on like a normal movie's thing, like a normal movie.
Too many ideas? What do you mean?
Too many like quote unquote things.
Things, you know?
Split screens, montage sequences, this, that, you know.
But it was like also hypnotizing. That's what I wrote down too. I was just like, and it felt so uncomfortable and like grimy. And then there would be these breaks of like him fantasizing about them on the pier or dreaming about them on the pier that were like fresh and clean.
Mm-hmm.
And like the feeling of the movie overall was so like, it really was visceral. I hate to say that word, but it felt it. Like,
and the music. I mean, you can't talk about this movie without talking about the score, which everybody listened to. It was like that Kronos Quartet, and you know,
yeah.
It was amazing. Like, whatever that one track was, it called like Eon Flux or something? Or
I didn't listen to it. I wasn't into the soundtrack, to be honest.
Oh, really? Yeah, that's great.
The score. I mean, I was like, ugh.
I remember like everyone I knew listened to it while studying. You know, that was the era of really listening to soundtracks.
Yeah. Chill beats. Yeah.
Chill beats. Yeah. Now it's like YouTube loops. But, you know, that was another thing that he had like this electronic musician working with Kronos Quartet, which was, you know, traditional group. And I think that there was a lot of ideas that went into making this movie that really were revolutionary and pushed the contemporary indie a little further, you know? Yeah.
Well, and the message of the movie, like, I get so frustrated sometimes when the Oscars come around and somebody gets up and like bloviates about how important movies are and how they change our lives. But this movie was like, oh fuck. Yeah. Like, you don't want to do drugs after this. Like, it's such an amazing depiction of how, I don't know, not easily, but like how drugs can help you descend into that dark place, and how they show you. There's a point when I forget exactly when it was, but like Jennifer Connelly, who's amazing in this, freaks out on Jared Leto because he had gone out and didn't come back in time. And she was like, she just wanted to get high. And she's like, not a person anymore. And she's like 100% just focused on getting high.
Yeah.
And the way they did that so well, and not judgmentally, and not like, I don't know, it just was so effective, I thought.
I agree. I love, yeah. I mean, she's wonderful in this movie. And the interesting scenes for me were those when she's at dinner with her shrink, who's the guy from Pi, actually.
Oh, okay. And the guy who's eating the steaks?
Yeah.
Yeah. He ate like five steaks or something during the filming. He was really? Like, yeah, that was, and that was a note, or that was something he didn't know was happening until he showed up to set. And then they just were like,
eating in movies is so gross.
Set steaks, disgusting.
Yeah,
set steaks. They're not like from a restaurant. They're like,
no, garbage. God. But she was so clearly on so many drugs, like grinding her teeth and playing it so well. You know, there's a subtle knowing quality. There's the overt drug use, and then there's the little things that I think really were incredible in the film. It's interesting thinking about movies that way, where your knowledge of the subject matter will heavily influence your appreciation of the thing, you know?
Yeah.
I don't think I knew when I watched the movie what someone who had like done a bunch of blow would look like, you know? Right. And you know, watching it as an adult, you're like, okay, they're not doing
it. It's not such a stretch anymore. Like, it feels a little bit more realistic, which is also dark.
Totally.
Oh shit. You can see how somebody gets to that point. And because like the first viewing was like, how the hell did she get to double dildo? You know, like, and then now it's like, oh yeah, I can see it.
That's like, I mean, for sure. Like that Keith David character is amazing. Like, he's so good, you know? It's funny seeing Leto.
Leto hadn't like, had he done much else aside from myself?
It was just Fight Club before this.
Oh, Fight Club. What? Fight Club? Is he in Fight Club?
I think, yeah, he's the pretty, I want to destroy something beautiful.
Oh.
And there's a lot, like, that's why one of the reasons I would say Fincher is a lot of Fight Club in this movie. You know, a lot of like subjective stuff, and I don't know, it's interesting to me.
Oh, I love, I mean, like, the going back to the drug theme, just that the movie was criticized for being so harsh on doctors and the healthcare system at the time, and it's now like, yeah, good. Beat those fuckers up because they are awful. The prescribing of the drugs to Ellen Burstyn's character for the diet pills. I love the detail that her doctor never looks her in the eye. Did you notice that?
Yeah, it was a great scene.
Oh my God. And the actor said that like he is like, that was the hardest note I've ever been given, to not be able to look at the actor that I was working
just
with.
Walks in that room. Like, I just looked at it. It's like such a set, you know, it's a doorway and a flat. And so he just is like, it's such a dark perspective on the medical industry.
Yeah. And then all the way throughout, there's like five doctors in the movie and they're all awful. And then in the end, she gets like, it's kind of like Cuckoo's Nesty too, where she gets taken into this hospital and then force fed, which was, that was the darkest part for me.
It gets like, so, because it all feels so close. Like it could be anyone's grandparents, you know?
Yeah.
It just felt really, really, and the electroshock therapy. I'd love to know if that was still actually happening because that was so hard to look at.
Yeah. I mean, I think, and like electroshock has gone through waves of acceptance in treatment for depression and whatever else, but like, because it can be effective. Who had it? I think Carrie Fisher had it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Unreal.
Isn't that wild? So you think it's this outdated, terrible, and but like apparently shock, like being shocked, like jumping in cold water, that can like actually help alleviate depression symptoms, but it is so barbaric and dangerous that
I've started the bandwagon. I think the whole bipolar thing is really obviously very popular now. I don't think it's something to be ashamed of at all. If there's bipolar 1 and 2, so, but bipolar 1 is could just be mistaken as someone who is addicted to drugs and alcohol.
Being in therapy and the electroshock therapy that you went through, which
still go through. You get put to sleep for, I don't know, about 10 minutes. And as you're going to sleep, they put a little, it's like a little piece of film. They put one here, here. And there's a medication that they give you now, so there's no convulsions. No, but it's really, it actually has really helped. I don't have to take as much medication, and it's gotten a really bad rap. You know, the only way it's shown in films is as a punishment.
It's wild. I mean, it's, I mean, all of it is also barbaric, and at the same time, like, who knows what works? You know, they're just trying. As like, it all comes from people trying, and then
yeah.
I have to go back there at some point. Can we pause? I have to go and look at a frame so I can send it to get approved, and then I can just sit back if that's okay for you.
Yeah, go do that. So we'll just like come back and say anything we missed and then wrap up.
Okay, I'll be right back.
Hi. All right, we had a little break. Let's wrap this shit up.
We had a little break. I recorded.
You had to go what? Look at a chair?
I had to shoot a chair. It's a point of view shot.
Oh, yeah. Love it. I can't wait. Can you tell me what the film is about? Do you want me to not mention
on no, the novel? It's White Noise. It's a novel by Don DeLillo. It's like a sort of, it's funny. It's like a non-pandemic movie. It's written in the 80s about this airborne toxic event that happens and everyone has to live in quarantine.
Ooh, chic.
Yeah, it's really, Prescient. It's a great book. Yeah, no kidding, right? So,
okay, I highlighted in my document the few things that I wanted to cover before we wrapped up.
Yeah, let's do it.
Oh, when she has the best seat in the line outside.
Oh my God, I love that. That little like micro social hierarchy.
Where nobody else cares about it, but she cares so much.
Yeah.
And you feel it for her because she's so good at it.
And the whole, whole dress thing. And
I almost fit into my dress.
It's so good.
God. Yeah.
She's wonderful, man. I edited her once and she's a powerhouse.
Oh my God. What insight do you have from like before they roll? What can you say?
She's just got an opinion. Like she's really talented. She's fully committed. And she, like, I don't know what kind of actor she is, you know, but she really, when she does it, she's just, and she's like, I wouldn't do that. This is more like what I would do, you know? And, but also seemed really, there was no vanity in that performance. There was nothing that was.
No, just, and that's what I mean when I say like, she really trusted him to like get so vulnerable and wild.
Yeah. I don't know. I thought, I mean, everyone really went for it. It's funny. Like Leto seems to just want to go for it. It's like his thing. And he kind of went for it less than everyone else. You
Except
know?
For like losing. He was so thin. Oh my God, you can like see his ribs through his t-shirt when they're at the hot dog stand. Like there's a shot from the back.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh my God.
I remember that
God,
shot too.
He is emaciated. He is like.
Yeah, he really, I mean, he goes for it. He always goes for it, you know. But all those, I mean, Connelly really also. I mean, she was so beautiful in the movie, but that bush shot that she did is iconic. I really remember
the
that.
The bush shot? What?
You know? Yeah, when she's got her shorts off and just her – like, or she has no underwear on, but she has a T-shirt on and she's just like standing in front of the mirror. Yeah. So –
that's so funny. Like, I like remember it, but that wasn't
– well, I remember it actually, I think, well, probably for sexual reasons, but not so much – I remember it as like a really interesting application of privacy in a film where it's like when – like why would you have – just a T-shirt on. Like somehow you ended up with your pants off.
She's Donald Ducking.
And I wonder if there's like a Reddit for that.
Our Donald Duck.
But I thought that was a really interesting way to stage a scene where, you know, there was no sexuality to the nudity. Yeah. It was just only vulnerability.
Yeah. There was another, I forget which actor, there was somebody who was in contention for the role and Neve Campbell. And because there was nudity,
one of my favorites.
She passed. Yeah.
Wow.
Fair enough. I mean, like, it's like once it's out, I used to be like, oh, God, who cares? It's just nudity. It's not a big deal. But like now, especially since, you know, that was pre-internet,
you
like
you don't own it.
It's gone. It's out there and it's not yours anymore. Okay. So the other point that I wanted to talk about was why didn't Jared Leto, speaking of his body, go out and prostitute himself? Yeah, he absolutely would have made so much money so quickly. And I was so confused about like why they couldn't find heroin in New York.
That was interesting, right? I mean, I don't know what I mean. I think he very well could have made a lot of money. I don't know if that is was too maybe risky for old Darren. Also
because it's based on the book, which was written in the 70s, and so maybe it wasn't as
but. It's Hubert Selby Jr., right? I don't think that would have... I mean, that seems like prime territory for him.
I don't know his work otherwise, so I couldn't say. But do you know... Did you read the book or you know him?
I did, yeah. I looked at that stuff. I mean, I always... When I was really into this stuff, I would always go after the books just to see... Because adaptations I find super fascinating. Like,
what's your favorite adaptation? What's the best book to screen?
I think you have to divide it into two categories.
Okay.
One is creative adaptation, like how do you take something and brilliantly bring it to the screen? And what's a great The Ice Storm, I think, is one of the best just like straight up perfect adaptations of a book.
Ang Lee for the win.
Yeah, Ang Lee for the win. James Sheamus for the win. Yes. His producer writer. But I really love Cronenberg Naked Lunch. I think that's an amazing adaptation. Oh, it's wonderful. He put the writer of the book into the thing. You know, like he took the life of the writer, like he took Burroughs and put him in the movie. And it was really incredible. Like there's certain autobiographical things and I don't know. I thought
that's
it was
the
really
one
good.
That took more license in being. So he like
super creative.
I mean, my favorite is Cider House Rules. Because
really
I read the book and then I saw the movie and I was like, this is exactly what I was picturing. Like, incredible.
That's so cool. That's so satisfying.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. I was like, this is what it looked like when I thought of it. It was,
wow. So. That's fun. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because is it the film's – I think if the book is beloved, it's the film's job to do that.
Yeah.
You know?
But I mean, like, it's so subjective too. Like, I mean, like, how could they, like, how, I don't know. I guess maybe Cider House Rules, it's a little bit easier because it's like apple orchards in the fall. How wrong can you go? But even Tobey Maguire.
Well, it's a characterization.
And like, they were all so good. It was like everything hit, like every single thing. So
what's your like movie comfort food? What is it? Like, what do you go for when you just want to feel relaxed?
I will watch Devil Wears Prada any day and like, like talk along to it as if it's a song, like,
like a friend.
It's really so easy and so not easy, but it's incredible. And I remember it's partially so special to me because I watched it before, I went to film school or anything. And I just was like, I love this movie. I don't know why. And I defended it really hard to somebody who was like, ew, that movie's so stupid. And I was like, there's two montages in the first 10 minutes. It's Patricia Field. It's Meryl Streep. And I was just like, this is amazing. Yeah. And like, yeah, it holds up and it's so fun. It's so fun. So yeah, that's mine.
I love that. I mean, I think those are our favorite movies, yeah, for real, are the ones that, you know, like Tim Burton's Batman, yeah, yeah, for me is amazing. Just like, will forever be one of the most special movies, yeah, to me, because it meant the, yeah, most to me in 91.
Yeah. Whatever, and I think like, and I know? Was just recording earlier with somebody else and, oh, sorry, you're not the first one today.
oh my God.
And I was talking about how music, I love music because it has, the music I love the most is because I had an experience with it in a film or something, or because of a certain time in your life. And that's what movies are. And that's why, like, in this podcast, so often the movies are from the 90s and 2000s, because that's when life was so good.
It was before we knew anything.
Can you imagine? Who knew life would get so awful? We're supposed to get easier. It's gotten worse and worse. Okay, wait. So one other point. It feels like Pee Wee Hermony when the fridge is chasing her around.
Yes.
But and also Little Shop of Horrors, kind of like Feed Me, Sarah. Yeah.
Totally, yeah. That's the hardest stuff to do. You have to really feel confident to make a fridge that's going to.
Yeah. And people, go, and one of the reviews, you know, I was reading, I think it was the same one with the that I read earlier, was like, a fridge chases her around with his teeth out. It's like, seriously? And it's like, well, yeah, that's that's fine. Just go with it, man. Relax.
Look, CNN is fake news. We all know CNN. That.
You, we were texting and you sent the ass to ass texts with the brackets, and it reminded me of Miranda, yes, July. Do you, yes, is that why you did it?
Yeah, and I really regretted not putting a hyphen for the dildo.
Like, oh my God, is that, did Miranda July get the pooping back and forth from ass to ass? Did she watch it and then just go,
That's a great idea.
Did you like Kajillionaire?
I haven't seen it.
Fucking love
I'll
it.
Admit it. I haven't seen it.
Love
is it great?
It's divisive. I gotta
watch it.
Yeah, it's fine. Okay, and then the final thing, which is the end of the movie, was everyone in the fetal position. Heartbreaking.
It was really, I find the movie, the end of the movie, very, very, yes, affecting. Him with the arm, I was like, oh
my God.
Guy.
No, even you though know? You can tell he's hiding his arm under the bed.
Totally.
I'm fine with
these
it.
Are the things we did, yeah, not recognize in the 2000s.
But I mean, like, and it's this like relief after such like the climax of the movie is torture. It's actual torture. It's just cutting between them in the worst moments of their life.
It really is a classically structured movie with a lot of alternative, yeah, approaches
and
to
stretching
the content, you know,
it's like hard parts, like, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think the movie is, as we said, a really, really strong contender for the classics. You know, the photography, the editing, the performances, the casting, like casting more and more. I don't know if you feel this, but as I go on, I realize casting is just such, right, a huge, yeah, part of it. You know, like you cannot change who you're, yeah, recording. It's just such an important thing. And this one was really brilliant, yeah, casting.
Well, it's funny because there was another movie that I was doing and, oh, it was To Die For. Have you seen that recently? Mm-hmm. So Nicole,
yeah,
Kidman,
yeah,
wasn't supposed to. It was supposed to have been Meg Ryan. Can you imagine that movie? Can you see that?
Totally different.
Like,
yeah, I mean, I could see the two of them being in contention. I can't picture the
casting,
the film.
Like you said, it's just like that is a 100% a different film than the Nicole Kidman film, and like the importance of the actor, even a, not, you know, like. The director is important and has a vision, but at the same time, it's like without a certain actor, the film would not be the same. Like you can't just plug people into a role. They're good. These stars are so powerful and so good at what they do that they're bringing their own vibe into it.
Well, and their personality, right? If you look at someone like Meg Ryan, she's so warm, so beautiful, so friendly. And Nicole Kidman has that sort of veneer, you know, like there's something icy. Yeah. I think it's really fascinating. And that movie, she's such a key part of it.
She's so incredible. But yeah, I mean, like Meg would have had to try so much harder to get to that place, whereas I feel like Nicole is just like like fit in.
Shows up. I mean, that's the thing is you kind of want people to not have to do much, you know?
Oh, God.
Which is
so who's in this movie that you're editing?
Adam Driver, Greta Gerwig, Don Cheadle. Those are the main people.
So exciting. And
some other bits and pieces. But
So you're on this until October. Halloween.
We're shooting until October.
When are you editing until?
Yeah.
2025? Till it's done. Is it a long editing process with Noah? Have you done? Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't. This is my first time working with him. I think we'll take our time. I mean, that's the nice thing about working with someone who's well into their career is that they can have the time to do it.
Whereas you always need time. You need time. I need to move on. I have other projects.
Well, it's funny. You can settle. I mean, that's the nice thing is that I can't think about it. And so this is just like what I'm doing and I'm just
And do you love Cleveland? You know? Is it fun?
I think Cleveland is a really interesting place. Like it's not, I can't move here, but I've enjoyed being here and it's fun finding your stuff, you know, this place. This is that. It's a lot like Toronto. What's funny about it is that it's upside down Toronto because the Lake Erie is to the north. So I'm always turning left instead of right because it's funny. Not right. Yeah. You know, it's really
the
weird.
North is your south. I'm so, I don't know. I'm just so, I can't say proud of you because I don't own you, but I'm so excited to see how well you're doing. Like, I feel like time, I don't know, just with, there was like a group of us in the 2000s and to see everybody doing so well right now, it's like amazing.
I love the moments where we can reconnect with each other and think it's like it's so nice to see how people are growing up into what they were always doing and
to
doing,
be like,
you know,
the thing that felt so far away is here. It's cool.
Yeah, it's really nice.
So, well, thank you so much for being on.
Thanks for having me.
What else do you want people to know? What do you want people to see? Where can people follow you?
Well, you know, the show that I did just came out that I'm really proud of called The North Water. It's the director is Andrew Haig.
Oh, amazing.
He did Weekend and 45 Years. And we made this series for the BBC that is out everywhere now, I think. It's coming out in Canada, came out in the States, and it came out in the UK. So I really love it. Colin Farrell and Jack O'Connell. And it's a crazy whaling drama.
God.
Really good.
Oh my God.
Yeah. This is it for now. Pals.
It's
old
so
chums.
Nice to see you. I mean, I hope we get to hang in real life.
It's nice to see
soon.
You too.
Are you going to come back to Canada?
I can't wait to come see you in Montreal.
Oh, yeah. Get back into your bed.
Okay. Well, it was great to see you.
Thanks for having me.
I'm so happy to have
Thank
done it with you.
You.
Sorry for all the hassle getting
fucking
done.
Diva to the through and through. All right. Good luck with your movie.
Bye.
Good luck to you. Bye.
Good to see you. Bye.
All right. Hope you enjoyed. Thank you for listening. Naked Lunch, The Ice Storm, and some of the Gus Van Sant movies we talked about are in the Criterion Collection, so go patronize those film bros if you want to. I want to say a huge thank you to all my guests. It takes a lot of time to rewatch these movies and think about them and then come on and take the time to talk about them. So I am eternally grateful to all my new pals and my old pals that I got to talk to this season. I want to thank my friend Will Lamont and David Wilson for encouraging me to do another season. I want to thank Michael Sherman for helping me find guests, and I want to thank all my naughties. It fills my heart to know you're out there listening. If you've enjoyed this season, send me fan mail, criterionaut@gmail.com. Leave a review and or a rating on Apple Podcasts. It helps tons. It helps me chart. It helps me get guests, so I'd really appreciate it. If you'd like, you can follow my personal Instagram, Graydon Shepherd. My goal is to start posting on the main grid again. I think I feel confident enough to do that now. All right. I don't know how, I don't know when, but I can't wait to be back together with you again. I love you, and I'll see you when I see you.